This is a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas, 91.3 KUAF. Good afternoon. It's about 6 minutes after 12. Ahead this afternoon, we hear a bit from Josh Stasi, a reporter covering the White House for the Washington Post. He's in Northwest Arkansas this week for Journalism Days at the University of Arkansas. And yesterday afternoon, he came to the Carver Center for Public Radio. Much of that conversation will be on our Monday edition next week, but we wanted to share a bit with you later today. After our show this afternoon, it's Here and Now from NPR. Today, Florida's Agriculture Commissioner, Nikki Freed, was the only Democrat elected statewide in 2018. She ran on a pro-medical marijuana platform. Now, she's appointed a new director of cannabis to promote hemp products. A conversation with her and more on Here and Now, beginning at 1 this afternoon on 91.3. The Northwest Arkansas Naturals take on the Springfield Cardinals at their 2019 season home opener tonight at 6:35 at Arvest Ballpark in Springdale. Seasoned and individual tickets, flex and mini-pack tickets, plus Kids Club and Silver Slugger registration are all available online at nwanaturals.com. When a person is diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, it can affect everyone in the family, including children and grandchildren. To help children better understand how to deal with this situation, the UAMS Schmieding Center for Senior Health and Education in Springdale is offering a free seminar for kids Saturday. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda traveled to Springdale yesterday to speak with Brandy Schneider, Director of Aging Services at UAMS Schmieding Center, to learn more about the program, which is being offered for the first time.
We recognize that there are more people who are coming in who have children involved or teenagers involved in either caring for a grandparent possibly or with how much we're seeing with younger onset. You know, there are people who are below 65, under the age of 65, who are being diagnosed with dementia. And so they often still have kids who are living at home or kids who have just left home. And so they are also involved in the care. And so as we have seen an increase in that or an increase in people getting help for that, we recognize that kids are needing some special attention for that as well.
Is there anything specific that prompted the creation of the seminar?
So we are very fortunate at UAMS to train the next generation of healthcare professionals also. And so I'm working with a social work intern, and she has an interest in both older adults and kids. And so we had a family member who was in one day, and she was talking about how difficult it has been for her kids in taking care of their dad who has dementia. And so it prompted me to talk to that social work intern about, hey, you know, here's a great way to use both of your interest areas. Let's develop a program for children and teens. And so she jumped right on that. And that's really, we are so fortunate to be able to use that energy of the youth that we have when we have interns here is that new, fresh energy. And so we're very fortunate to be able to have them bring fresh ideas to that as well. So that's really what prompted the idea to go ahead and get that started.
So what will the structure of the seminar be on Saturday?
So there will be an educational component to that. So we're going to discuss things like changes in the brain, different communication techniques, but we will also have a lot of hands-on activities that just help the kids to understand why the changes are happening in the brain and what that might feel like and look like to someone who's actually experiencing dementia. And then hopefully that will help them to be able to better communicate with people with dementia and understand how they need to do that. And we're hopeful too. We know it's incredibly hard for adults to understand what is happening in the brain of someone with dementia. And sometimes kids pick up on that a little bit more quickly and easier. And so we're hoping that with the information they learn, they can help their parents or grandparents also learn how to better communicate and how to sort of preserve that dignity for people with dementia and Alzheimer's as well.
As you say, it's difficult for adults. So how do you find the language to explain dementia to a child in a way that they can understand?
Yeah. So I think it's the hands-on activities. We have developed a lot of, great, just here's what the brain looks like. Here Some things that we're going to do are like different word scrambles and things like that, so that they understand maybe how someone with dementia is hearing what they say. So it's just having those hands-on activities that really help them to understand what the brain looks like. And there are some resources out there, some books that are written for children that we plan on using some of that as well, just to sort of help them to understand. Teenagers especially, I think they pick up on these things pretty quickly. You know, I've worked with teenagers in the past who are taking care of a loved one with dementia, and they seem to pick up on those language skills and those communication skills rather quickly. I think it's a pretty natural fit for a lot of them too.
With dementia, and I think a lot of times specifically Alzheimer's, you obviously have the part of the confusion or the forgetfulness, but one aspect of the disease is sometimes they can be aggressive.
Right.
How do you explain that to a child or tell them how to deal with that? Because it seems like it's one thing to be like, well, grandpa is having trouble remembering this story, but, you know, if he gets angry, how do you... Right. I think that's difficult for adults anyway, again.
Yeah, it's very difficult for adults to understand that. So a lot of that is just talking about the personality changes that happen and why those things happen and what to do in those situations. Is it better to just back off and go into another room? You know, how do we communicate with someone who's acting a little bit more aggressively towards us? And I think for kids, well, even for adults, there's a fear with that aggression. And for kids, that's really scary if, you know, this isn't like my dad or this isn't like my grandpa to lash out at me. So what do I do with that anger? And part of the structure of the program also will just be some time to share and have support so that they can talk to other people who are experiencing the same things they do. And, you know, we know that with the aggression and the loss of inhibitions, you know, often we'll hear teenagers say, I can't bring friends over because I never know what my grandpa might do or might say. And, you know, I don't know how to explain to my friends that what he's saying isn't really his fault, that it's just part of his disease. And so we'll have some time to share and really talk about those things and talk about their own specific situations. So if this is happening at home with my grandpa, we can talk really specifically about here's what you might try or here's probably the best way to handle that, so that they get some support in how to handle that on a one-on-one situation as well. And then, of course, we want to be able to continue to offer that support to them. So just because the class is over doesn't mean they can't contact us and say, here's something that's happening and what should we do about that? So we're looking at ways to continue that support with them as well.
It sounds like just the process of discussing this might be therapeutic for some of the kids because maybe it's not something that they felt comfortable talking to their friends about. And right. And you talk about continuing to support them after the seminar. Are there support groups for kids or something like that?
So we don't currently have a support group for kids. We are hoping to talk to them since this is our first class and see what format they might want to do to continue that support. So we're looking at, you know, possibly doing something online where they can just, you know, type in their questions. You know, they don't have to be someplace at a certain time. We know how hard it is to get kids to be someplace at a certain time these days with all the activities they have. So is there, you know, and kids are great with online formats. So is there a place that they can just type in questions and answers and they can all go in there and read those and answer those. And then we as staff can check in on them and answer their specific questions as well. So we're going to talk to them. We plan on talking to them on Saturday and just asking them what their source of support would look like. This is a great opportunity for those kids to sort of be on the cutting edge of what we're doing here for kids and teens in Northwest Arkansas as well.
Is there a certain age group that this is designed for? And for some of the younger kids, should their parents come with them?
Yeah. So we're leaving it up to the parents if they want to come or if they just want to drop them off for a couple of hours. So we are doing kids from ages 8 to 12 from 10 to noon, and then we'll do teenagers from 1 to 3 in the afternoon.
And how do I register? It's free.
Yes. So they can call 479-751-3043. Or if they want to register online, they can go to uamscaregiving.org/springdale/youth.
What else should we know?
We just really welcome anyone coming. And if you don't get registered, please come anyway. We know we're not going to hold that against you if you didn't register. We want to get as many kids as we can here this weekend and just really give them the support that they need. And then we will continue to offer this. So if you can't come this weekend, don't stress about that. We will continue to offer this on a periodic basis for kids.
And we've talked specifically about Alzheimer's, but would this seminar be good for anybody dealing with a family member with dementia of some type?
Yes, any type of dementia. And we will talk about the different types of dementia and what that looks like as well.
Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you. We're really excited to get this program started.
That was Brandy Schneider, Director of Aging Services, speaking with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda. Saturday's free seminar will be at the UAMS Schmieding Center for Senior Health and Education, which is located at 2422 North Thompson Street in Springdale. You can register at uamscaregiving.org/springdale/youth. A bill that would impose harsher penalties on people convicted of animal cruelty in Arkansas failed to pass the Arkansas House yesterday. The bill, sponsored by Republican Representative Jim Servillo of Little Rock, would have raised the fines for cruelty towards dogs and cats and made repeat offenses a felony. Presenting his bill on the House floor, Servillo said stiffer penalties for first-time offenders would serve as a deterrent.
Remember, this is the discretion of the court. Not this bill, but the discretion of the court. What we've said to try to send a message, we need to raise that. It's a misdemeanor, and we need to raise that up to $2,500.
Currently, a first-time animal cruelty offense carries a fine between $150 and $1,000. The bill would have also made a third cruelty offense against dogs and cats within 5 years of a previous offense a Class D felony. The bill failed to pass the House on a vote of 26 to 41. Meanwhile, a House committee is advancing a proposed constitutional amendment to the legislature that, if placed on the ballot and then approved by voters, would make it harder to have future amendments to the Constitution adopted. The proposal would, among other changes, require a higher level of support in the House and Senate and move up deadline for citizens to submit a proposed amendment. If this current measure receives simple majority approval in the House and Senate, it would be in front of voters in November 2020.
Ozarks at Large is supported by the Center for Arkansas and Regional Studies at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, dedicated to the celebration and documentation of this region's history and culture.
Covering the White House and the president for a news outlet isn't a job that's ever seemed simple. But covering the White House and the president in 2019 is surely as challenging as the beat has ever been. An unconventional presidency, an around-the-clock news cycle, and Twitter help make for unprecedented times. Josh Stassi covers the White House and President Trump for The Washington Post. Previously, he'd covered Governor Chris Christie and New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio while working at Politico and The Wall Street Journal. Last night, he delivered the 2019 Roy Reed Lecture as part of the annual Observation of Journalism Days at the University of Arkansas. Before the talk, he came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio to talk to us about his job. Most of the conversation will be on our show Monday, but we did want to share some of that visit yesterday. Josh Stassi says covering figures like Donald Trump and Chris Christie keeps a reporter's attention finely tuned.
Of course. No one wants to be at a center of a boring story or covering someone that is not a dynamic or interesting character. I mean, they're all interesting in their own ways, right? Chris Christie is this larger-than-life, pugnacious bully who had, you know, crazy political ambition, was going to be the likely Republican nominee at a lot of counts, and then, you know, was plagued by scandal, kind of an Icarus-like figure that flew a little too close to the sun. And being part of that story, obviously, with the closing of the bridges in New Jersey was interesting. I mean, covering de Blasio was a great story, you know, because he's leading a $90 billion biggest city in the country, you know, thorny municipal issues, homelessness, murders, you know, trying to make New York City, which has been called the ungovernable city, I'm not sure what it is, but trying to make it run correctly while he was trying to build, you know, an ambitious Democratic national profile. And then Trump is fascinating for all the reasons you would imagine. You know, I've covered him since the transition in 2016, so 2.5 years now, and I have not been bored yet.
So you have City Hall, you have State House, you have the White House. Are there similarities between those three levels of government for a reporter?
There are a lot of similarities between the federal government and the State House. I think New York City in some ways is its own beast. I mean, when you're covering, you know, Chris Christie or Donald Trump, you're looking at, you know, a lot of budget issues, a lot of of, you know, national security issues with, you know, Christie, when I was covering him, he was a presidential candidate. You're looking at, you know, big thorny kind of national issues. New York City, I think what is helpful doing is New York City has a pace and the environs are so aggressive and it's such a, you know, large press corps, it's so competitive and so tough on each other that it really is the only thing that can prepare you for covering this White House, is being in that kind of similar you know, environment where the same qualities are benefited or valued. The same qualities are the things that get you, you know, ahead of the pack, you know. Aggressive press corps that sits together, that's competing for every story, that's looking for every nugget, looking for every interview. City Hall, I mean, it's not – the White House is obviously even more competitive than City Hall, but City Hall is the only thing that I think could prepare you for that.
Yeah, let's talk about that competition, because you've got the best of the best generally covering – and it's a 24-hour cycle now.
Right.
You know, someone's going to break a story maybe at 2 in the morning or maybe at 2 in the afternoon.
Right.
What is that like?
Well, it certainly keeps you on your toes at all times. I mean, the president is up 19 hours a day himself usually. I mean, he goes to bed at 12 or 1 a.m. and gets up at 5 or 6. He's not a man who sleeps much. And some of his most newsworthy pronouncements come at 6:50 in the morning or at 11:30 at 9. And you have to be ready. It kind of have to pivot and go at all times when he does that. You know, newsrooms, I think, in general, have become more adept to covering him. They've hired folks whose job it is to work late hours. They've hired more people whose job it is to staff him on the weekends. I mean, they're trying to get to a point, because he creates so much more news than traditional presidents, that the size and the contents and the schedules and the processes of a normal White House team just don't work with this guy. And there's been a lot of thought at the Post and the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal about how you staff a newsroom for a president that never sleeps.
Do you personally, first thing you do, look at Twitter in the morning to see what he's
Absolutely. And the last thing I do before I go to bed. And if you look in the morning and there's a lot of new things that have happened in the 7 hours that you've been sleeping, you've got problems.
So how do you – what's the process of saying, oh, well, this is a provocative tweet, but it may not necessarily warrant my time because I'm also thinking about an immigration issue? Or when do you say, uh-oh, this might be my full attention for the day?
Well, that's the quintessential question of his presidency. You know, some of the tweets are kind of like the famous definition of porn. You know it when you see it, right? I mean, sometimes he tweets something that's so newsworthy or incendiary or interesting or new that everyone knows in that moment, you stop what you're doing, it's going to be your story for today. There are other times where he says things that he said before, and maybe the first three times he said it, it was surprising to folks. Now it's no longer. I mean, for example, his attacks on Senator John McCain. Mm-hmm. You know, the first few times he attacked a dead senator, everyone was kind of outraged in Washington and a lot of even his own party. And he's done it so often now that sometimes it doesn't still get that attention that it did at first. You know, sometimes we kind of, you know, look at these things and try to figure out our schedule that we can do both, right? I mean, there's a tweet and sometimes, you know, someone will get up and file a quick story and then move on to something else for the day, you know, kind of triage your work through what your assignments are and his news. And, you know, we have someone at the Post who's kind of on duty at all times to handle whatever he's doing in that moment. And that's kind of a necessary function, I think, at this point.
Josh Stasi covers the White House for The Washington Post. Last night, he delivered the Roy Reed Lecture as part of Journalism Days at the University of Arkansas. We'll have much more from our conversation that was recorded yesterday at the Carver Center for Public Radio on Monday's edition of Ozarks at Large, including how Josh put together the news story for The Washington Post, for which he just earned the award for news coverage under deadline pressure from the White House Correspondents Association. And this was on the story when the president referred to countries of possible immigrants as, well, we'll say it, S-hole countries.
Correct. Here. That's a good way to say it.
Yes. Which, so you hear about this, you have a deadline, you've got to confirm this because this isn't right. Something you just report.
Right. It's not something that you just report on a whim.
So are you on your cell phone? Are you texting? Are you getting multiple?
Sure.
You've got to find out who's in the room.
That
right?
day, the tip came to me within 45 minutes of a meeting. Someone who emerged from the White House said to me, he said something very offensive about countries, about immigrant countries.
Reporting that story on Deadline, getting the sources straight, and more. From Josh Stasi on Monday's Ozarks at Large on 91.3 KUAF. Still to come on our show, yield curve inversion. What is that?
Well, I think there are a lot of yield curve evangelists out there in the world, and they talk about the yield curve like it is the second coming of Christ, and its predictive powers are amazing. Now, what is true about the yield curve is that it has correctly predicted the last few recessions. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to predict every recession in the future.
Mervyn Jebaraj, director of the Center for Business and Economic Research at the Sam M. Walton College of Business at the University of Arkansas, explains yield curve inversion on the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report with Paul Gatling. That's in about 20 minutes on this Thursday, Ozarks at Large. At 8 sites around Northwest Arkansas, a dedicated group of Ozark master naturalists are providing accommodations for nesting birds. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich recently met up with two nest box experts at one of the habitats on Beaver Lake.
Steve Sampers and Emily Robertson hiked this cold early March morning through a federal metal gate down a dirt road into an oak, hickory, and pine forest in eastern Benton County. They climbed to the top of a steep berm surrounding a fish nursery pond operated by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers for trout and walleye, adjacent to Beaver Lake. Surrounding the nursery pond at 300-foot intervals stand an array of nesting boxes on posts, a mile walk around. And during the breeding season?
This place is just swarming with tree swallows and bluebirds, and you'll see waterfowl out in the little pond. It's just a wonderful place to come and visit.
We walk past a bird blind where visitors can relax and observe the nesting birds, as well as river otters, coyotes, foxes, raptors that also inhabit this place year-round. It's a little early in the season, but Sampers and Robertson check a large wood duck box for any nesting activity.
There's no wood chips. We need to put some wood chips in here. We have some repair to do on this box. Get it ready for the wood ducks. Oh, there you go. Good.
Next, Sampers checks a bluebird nesting box.
We tap on the box to let them know that we're coming and give them a chance to go, and always stand off on the side, because if they come out, I don't want to swallow them. Now here, it looks like the flying squirrel has a nest in here, and it's not active right now. In fact, I'm gonna clean it out, get ready for the start. And oh, do you see the mud dauber nests in there? Oh, that's terrible. We're gonna have to get in here and clean this box out.
He replaces the cover. The constructed birdhouses feature either hinged or latched access hatches. Back at his truck, Steve Samper shows us four newly constructed nesting boxes.
Bluebird boxes and prothonotary boxes, the small birds. We like to use a cedar picket fence. It's a 3/4 inch by 5.5 picket fence that we use to build our bird houses with. Now, some of our larger birds, like owls and wood duck, we use plywood.
The boxes are bolted together with galvanized screws. The larger plywood nesting box is painted in green tones.
And we have vents in the bottom to allow drainage as well as ventilation. The bottom is recessed to keep the moisture from flowing from the sides. We have an overhang, a slanted overhang on the top so that the water drains. We have about a 3-inch overhang in the front of the box so that the water doesn't drain down to the hole.
All the nesting boxes are branded with the Arkansas Master Naturalist logo. The bluebird boxes are 10 inches deep, warbler nesting boxes 8 inches deep, owl boxes 18 inches, and wood duck boxes are 2 feet tall and 1 foot wide.
The owl box, the top's open. They lift up so that we can observe the eggs and the hatchlings as they develop.
Bluebirds lay light blue eggs. Chickadees, white eggs with fine speckles. Swallows, Samper says, prefer white feathers to line their nests. Taken from other birds, from mid-March to end of summer, a troop of volunteers monitor this nesting box site, charting activity to observe trends. Coordinated by Emily Robertson, each box activity is mapped, and monitors are required to fill out data, noting number of eggs, incubation, hatchlings, and fledglings.
We have probably 8 people that monitor this location, and they usually come out like once a week or once every 10 days. And we follow the Cornell Lab's protocol and code of conduct. So we do a teaching class in the spring when we have new monitors, and we tell them this is how you should do it. And this is when you should come out, you know, not so that you don't disturb the birds as any more than you have to.
For example, monitors are asked to avoid checking boxes when females or fledglings are present. Samper says if disturbed, mother birds will usually fly off to a nearby branch and wait.
Watching us and says, please move on. And so we normally stay at the nest for approximately 1 minute. And then we move on.
Emily Robertson and her late husband, William, established the Northwest Arkansas Chapter of Master Naturalists in 2009. The chapter went on to establish this nesting box habitat 2 years later in collaboration with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Previously, 20 boxes had been installed by a Boy Scout troop, but many of the birdhouses were destroyed by vandals or ripped off.
And so they were all broken. So we then repaired them, and we now have 49 boxes around this nursery pond. You know, and there's a variation of types of boxes. We've got the wood duck boxes, the prothonotaries, the bluebird and tree swallows, because in the summertime, the tree swallows are usually the major bird here.
The nesting boxes are mounted on steel posts, Steve Samper says, covered with 4-inch-wide painted PVC pipe as baffles to deter raids by cats, raccoons, and snakes.
They're after food, and the little birds and the eggs are food.
One experimental post contains both a bluebird and swallow nesting box, what Emily Robertson calls the condo.
And they say don't do that because they are territorial. But usually what will happen is a tree swallow will get in one box, the bluebird gets in the other box, and because tree swallows tend to swarm, that helps defend the bluebird box. So if there's a cat or a raccoon or whatever, the tree swallows will chase away the predator because the bluebirds are not that aggressive, you know.
These tree-caviting nesting birds need help, Samper says, because forests in the two-county region continue to disappear.
The bluebird population was decreasing because of the lack of habitat nesting for them. We picked up on providing habitat for them, and it's worked. The bluebird population is really stabilized and increasing, so we're real pleased about that.
At the end of the breeding season, Robertson says the nesting box team do housekeeping.
Our monitor comes by and cleans out the boxes, make sure that, you know, if there's any little mites or ants or whatever, because sometimes if one of the babies dies, then of course you get all these little insects in there. So we spray the boxes with a solution of like 50-50 of water and bleach, Clorox solution. So that kind of helps. And just leave it open, let it dry, and then you close it back up, and then the next little bird comes along and builds another nest. And at the end of the breeding season, like August or September, we'll go back through and we'll clean them all out again and make sure they're nice and clean. And because a lot of the bluebirds especially will reuse the box in the wintertime if it's really cold. It's a nice little place for like a group of them to gather and stay warm. So we like to make sure they have a nice clean house to go back to.
The Northwest Arkansas Chapter of Master Naturalists have established nesting boxes at seven other sites, including Hobbs Visitor Center, Wilson Springs in Fayetteville, Withrow Springs State Park, Illinois River Watershed Partnership Cave Springs Park, and Lake Leatherwood in Eureka Springs. Steve Sampers and Emily Robertson encourage the public to assist nesting birds by installing bird boxes in backyards and on rural property. Cornell Lab of Ornithology's Nest Watch provides guidance. It's online based on ecoregions on how to build bird boxes for various species of birds. And you can also purchase nesting boxes for the birds. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
You can find a Nest Watch link to Cornell Lab of Ornithology at ozarksatlarge.com. You probably didn't need to add one more concern to your list, but John David McFarland, retired Arkansas chief geologist, says Arkansas is at great risk of experiencing a large, damaging earthquake in the not-too-distant future. The danger is most acute in northeastern Arkansas along the New Madrid Fault. This weekend, McFarland, who is chairman of the Arkansas Earthquake Advisory Panel for 21 years, will discuss earthquakes, damage, and more at Hobbs State Park Visitor Center. His talk is Sunday afternoon at 2. It's free, and it's open to the public. You can find out more at friendsofhobbs.com. This is Ozarks at Large.
Land for Life Gala, A Night Under the Stars, is Friday, April 19th at the Pratt Place Barn in Fayetteville. This inaugural fundraiser benefiting the Northwest Arkansas Land Trust includes a cocktail happy hour, farm-to-table dinner, live entertainment, and more. Tickets and information available at nwalandtrust.org.
With me inside the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Lee Wood, host and producer of the KUAF Vinyl Hour, every Saturday evening at 5 on 91.3, every Sunday evening at 5 on KUAF 3. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Going to have some vinyl this weekend.
Yes, we are. I think that it's time to have a spring mix. You know, I like to listen to music that kind of feels right for the seasons for me, weather related. Mm-hmm. Is there music that you listen to when it's springtime?
Los Lobos.
There you go.
Yeah.
See? So this is a mixture of some new and some old and songs that I just think would be pleasant to listen to on your patio or maybe driving in your car with your windows down.
Exactly. So yeah. Sort of breezy?
There's a breeziness. I noticed as I was getting ready for it, there's a lot of themes of I don't care.
Yes.
There's sort of a, yeah, so it's sort of a sloughing off of caring or worrying. Yeah.
And I imagine that might dovetail also with a new start.
Yes.
Unshackling, you know, spring cleaning sort of.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Exactly. And there's some songs that I included that are really important to me from my childhood that I've just been able to buy recently and I haven't been able to play on the show. One of them is Phoebe Snow.
Ah.
Do you know Phoebe Snow?
She was a musical guest on the first ever Saturday Night Live.
No way.
Yep.
Well, there you go. I love this record. This is a part of listening in my household when I was a kid. And I love it, too, because I got it. It was like a bargain bin record. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those where just because it's a bargain bin doesn't mean it's not fantastic.
Oh, right. Her big hit was Poetry Man.
Well, yes. And so there's this one, which is Second Childhood, is just full of great songs.
So love Phoebe it. Snow from the early to mid-1970s.
Also, there's a song from Daylight Again, which is a Crosby, Stills, and Nash record.
Yep.
From, I think it's close to 1980, if it's not in the 80s, 82.
Yeah.
And it has one of my favorite songs of all time on it, Southern Cross.
Mm-hmm. That's very much a spring song.
Yeah, that has to be included. And then there's a mixture of newer bands that I love, Built to Spill, Foxygen, The Raining Sound, which was a band from Memphis that mm-hmm. put out a great record called Shattered. Lots of different mixtures of things, some jazz, too.
All right. So a spring mix on the Vinyl Hour Saturday evening at 5 on 91.3, Sunday evening at 5 on KUAF3. Lee, thank you very much.
Thanks, Kyle.
the town, on a boat, going to Southern Islands. Sailing to reach before a following sea. She was making for the trades on the outside.
Northwest Arkansas welcomes plenty of visitors to the area every day, including those who come to create and those who come from distant locations. Kevin McLaughlin fits into both categories. The singer-songwriter, who is originally from the Yukon, is in Northwest Arkansas this week as a guest of the House of Songs to perform in the community and to co-write new songs with local artists. Wednesday morning, he stopped by the Furman Garner Performance Studio to sit down with Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis to talk about his visit to the region and to give us a brief taste of his music.
Is this your first time in Arkansas?
This is.
Well,
yeah.
Welcome.
Thank you.
What are your thoughts so far?
Honestly, I've been blown away. I didn't have like much of an expectation really coming down, but certainly when I, you know, told people I'm going on Arkansas, people were like, "Oh, Arkansas," you know, and I think there's perhaps a perception of what people are like here.
Yeah.
And from people I've spoken to, it seems like you guys face that a lot. But I was, all that was immediately blown out of the water, and like everyone has been so kind, so welcoming, and I'm just amazed by, like, Fayetteville, Bentonville are both, like, hip and trendy, and everyone's biking, and there's hipster coffee shops and breweries and all these things that are, like, now are becoming, like, staples of any city. And at the same time, yeah, that friendliness and, like, being able to bike everywhere, these sorts of things that are just, like, make little towns like this magic.
Yeah.
Plus, I saw the Walmart Museum, so I'm doing my due diligence while I'm here.
Do you feel like, and this is just kind of a broad question, do you feel like Canadian culture and Southern culture have anything in common? Oh, I mean, I know you've only been here a couple days.
Great question.
But just from your immediate perceptions.
Yeah, I mean, ironically, I felt more at home here than in Toronto compared to where I grew up.
How so?
Part of that is because, I mean, like, it's, I can see how prevalent nature is here. I mean, driving through all these woods and forests and all the trails that are, like, right near downtown. But it was more that friendliness. I mean, like, everyone here looks you in the eyes when you pass by them on the sidewalk and wants to say hello. And, like, Jamie Lou, when she was taking me around town, we couldn't go into a coffee shop or a grocery store without someone she knew saying hi and me getting to be introduced to someone else. And that, like, community side of things, that sort of small-town energy is, I mean, that takes me home. That's totally the kind of environment I grew up in. And I mean, I lamented that as a kid, that my inability to go anywhere with my mom without her, of course, running into someone she knew. And while I love Toronto, and Toronto is a very friendly city, it's also just, you know, busy enough and big enough that people get in their own lane, you know, and kind of keep their head down and their shoulders down too. So I was honestly surprised that I found myself really connecting. I mean, basically like 3,000 miles away.
Right. Well, you're here writing at the House of Songs.
Yeah.
What are you going to be doing besides writing while you're here?
At first, I mean, just taking in the town, and I've got a few different co-writes set up with people from around here, and then also just playing at different events. So I think First Friday is this Friday, and I'm just going to be out there busking and taking in the other bands that are playing. And then Saturday night at Bike Rack at 7 p.m., we're doing kind of like a Songwriters in the Round showcase. So we're going to be a part of that as well.
Sometimes you give it and they keep it. Sometimes they don't give it back. Sometimes you hear it when you need it. Sometimes it just falls flat. One time I said it, then pretended I was asleep. I was scared they wouldn't say it too. One time I said it and they didn't even hear it. They didn't have to, they knew. There's a million different things I've said, and there's a million things I'll do. But if you only remember one of them, let it be that I love you. Sometimes you say it like a habit. Sometimes you need the echo. Sometimes you feel you have to say it. Sometimes you don't, you just go. One time I heard it yelled across the room at a drunken house party back home. One time I heard it alongside the wrong name, and that night I left alone. There's a million different things I've said, and there's a million things I'll do. But if you only remember one of them, let it be that I love you.
That was Kevin McLaughlin speaking Wednesday morning with Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis. We'll have more from their conversation on an upcoming edition of Ozarks at Large. In the meantime, Kevin will perform at First Friday in Bentonville tomorrow, and he'll also be part of the monthly House of Songs Songwriter Showcase in Bentonville. That takes place at 7 p.m. Saturday evening at Bike Rack Brewing Company in Bentonville. Tickets are $10. You can find out more about Kevin's music on his Facebook page. Tomorrow on Ozarks at Large, early voting has started in Fayetteville for a series of bond issues, one of which would provide for improvements for police and fire services.
When you look around the area at the other police departments, they're all have new police departments, or they're building new police departments. And when it comes to recruiting the best candidates, we want to be able to pull the best candidates that we can have.
But not everybody is on board.
When folks try to minimize the significance of it, I find it a little disingenuous. And I feel like the pennies count, and the pennies count for my clients, and the pennies count for low-income families and people.
Why some residents are voting against the bond package. That's on tomorrow's Ozarks at Large at noon and 7 on 91.3 KUAF.
Welcome to another edition of the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. I'm Paul Gatling. By now, you may have heard details of a big announcement made Monday morning in downtown Bentonville that will one day add to the skyline of downtown Bentonville. New York-based startup WeWork is planning to build a 200,000-square-foot building near the downtown square. The future site is on South Main Street on a lot of about 1.5 acres. If you are unfamiliar, WeWork is a privately held real estate and technology company that provides shared office spaces around the world. The company is less than 10 years old, but already it has 425 locations in more than 100 cities across 27 countries. For another perspective, all those locations combine for about 45 million square feet of office space. The WeWork building in downtown Bentonville will obviously have multiple floors, though the exact number is not determined. It's also one of the company's first ground-up developments, expected to accommodate retail, community space, and a workplace for more than 3,200 people. A groundbreaking for the building likely won't be until 2020. There's much more on this story on our website at nwabusinessjournal.com. When we come back, we'll visit with University of Arkansas economist Mervin Jebaraj. You're listening to the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report right here on Ozarks at Large.
Support for the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report is provided by the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas. The Chamber's mission is to promote a pro-business, free enterprise agenda and prevent legislation, regulation, and rules that hinder business. More at ArkansasStateChamber.com. First Security is proud to be only in Arkansas, and it shows in your banking experience. They offer smart solutions for personal and business banking, plus convenient services and community investment. That's because First Security is 100% focused on serving customers all across the state and nowhere else. It's local banking with local commitment. First Security. Bank better. Member FDIC. Equal housing lender. And OneCom. OneCom provides communications options to help your business adapt to today's demands with tomorrow's technology. With opportunities in virtualization, redundancy, or maximizing your efficiency. Learn more at onecom.com. That's 1-COMM.com.
University of Arkansas economist Mervin Jebaraj admits that the yield curve inversion has been an accurate predictor of past recessions, But he warns that the current economic environment has many variables that suggest reliance on the often used indicator should be cautious. Jeb Baraj appeared on this week's edition of Talk Business and Politics and had this to say about the predictive powers of the yield curve and what it means for the national economy. Here he is with Roby Brock.
Here we have heard a lot about yield curve inversion. I want you to tell everybody what yield curve inversion is, and is it really an accurate prediction of what might happen in the near-term future for the economy, or is it just more of a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy?
Well, I think there are a lot of yield curve evangelists out there in the world, and they talk about the yield curve like it is the second coming of Christ, and its predictive powers are amazing. Now, what is true about the yield curve is that it has correctly predicted the last few recessions. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to predict every recession in the future. Now, what it is essentially this. There are, you know, short-term bonds and long-term bonds. Long-term bonds in general have higher interest rates because people have to give up their money for longer periods of time. Risk factors are higher over a longer time period. Inflation risks might be higher over a longer time period. So in general, long-term bonds, say 10-year treasuries, have higher yields than short-term bonds, say 3-year, 2-year treasuries. Now, when there is a threat of a recession, this switches over because people expect short-term treasuries to lose value as the Federal Reserve drops its rates because we're headed towards a recession. So people are more willing to get into long-term bonds even though there are low yields. So what this does is it inverts the curve where the difference between the long-term and short-term treasuries turns negative, and that's what we call a yield curve inversion. So in the past, this is, you know, the reason why the yield curve inverts is important. So if the yield curve is inverting because people are fleeing short-term treasuries into long-term treasuries because they think there's a recession, then I think the yield term, a yield curve inversion works as a good predictor of recessions. But I don't think that that's why long-term treasuries have lower yields. I think long-term treasuries have lower yields for a couple of different reasons. Developed economies across the world are in lower growth cycles, like the United States and the European Union. We're thinking about our long-term growth being closer to about 2%, not higher than that. So that flattens the yield curve as it is, so it makes yield curve inversions a lot more likely. Global inflation expectations, especially inflation expectations here in the United States, are well anchored below 2%. So again, that flattens the yield curve, making yield curve inversions more likely. And the other factor to remember is that the Federal Reserve has a massive balance sheet that they accumulated as part of quantitative easing and some of the other actions that they took after the last recession. And what they did was bought up a whole bunch of long-term treasuries, which pushed down their yields. And the Federal Reserve is still holding on to a lot of these long-term treasuries. They have divested some of these treasuries, but they're stopping that process later this year. So that puts negative pressure on yields as well, in the sense that the Federal Reserve holds a lot of treasuries and yields are lower. So for a variety of different reasons, the long-term yields are lower that don't have to do with people fleeing short-term for long-term because of economic short-term economic prospects. So that's not to say that we're not likely to see a recession next year. It's just to say that maybe the yield curve inversion stops being as good a predictor because of some other structural issues in our economy.
Jeb Baraj also discussed the revisions that came to Arkansas's employment numbers last year.
With the unemployment unemployment rate this low, the one positive that we've seen from all of it is that wages have finally gone up for workers. In the last 2 years, we've averaged about 2% wage growth on a year-over-year basis. For all private sector workers in Arkansas, adjusted for inflation. So we've taken away the effect of inflation, and they're still making 2% more on a year-over-year basis. And this was in 2017 and all of 2018, too. So that's the really good piece of news from the unemployment rate. You know, it's not just nice to see a low headline unemployment rate. You want to get the positive effects of the low unemployment rate, which would be wage increases for workers across the state. So that's a positive. The other news that hasn't gotten a whole lot of attention that is important as well is that, you know, we've gotten the expected revisions that come every year in March. And this year, the revisions are a lot more significant than they usually were in previous years from the BLS. And what that has done is that it has made the labor force decline not as bad in 2018 in Arkansas. So previously, before the revisions, we were looking at going from a 1% labor force growth rate to about negative 1% So a large swing in the labor force growth rate in Arkansas. After the revisions, we went from about positive 1% labor force growth rate to about just under 0% labor force growth rate. So still the labor force overall did decline in Arkansas, but the decline wasn't as steep as we thought it was. And this, you know, goes through the metro areas as well as the non-metro areas too. And so combined with that, the revisions that we got on the employment side and the payroll side of the employment show that Arkansas not only added jobs in the metro areas of Northwest Arkansas, Central Arkansas, and Jonesboro, but some of the other metro areas added a few jobs. And the rural areas added a few thousand jobs and didn't lose as many jobs as we thought they did in before the revisions.
And you can watch that entire interview with Mervyn Jebaraj online at nwabusinessjournal.com, where you will also find the latest issue of the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal. The digital version is now online, and you can read it for free. It features a cover story on Onyx Coffee Lab co-owners John and Andrea Allen. And that's all for today. We'll be back Sunday morning with another Northwest Arkansas Business Journal report right here on Ozarks at Large. Until then, I'm Paul Gatling. Thanks for listening.
Contributors to today's show included Antoinette Grajeda, Jacqueline Froelich, Timothy Dennis, and Zuzanna Sitek. Timothy Dennis mastered our show. And we appreciate Lee Wood for stopping by. You can hear the KUAF Vinyl Hour Saturday evening at 5 on 91.3. The Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report with Paul Gatling, provided through our partnership with Talk Business and Politics. You can read more at talkbusiness.net. A listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas, this is 91.3 KUAF Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Clifty. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. We're back with new shows tomorrow at noon and 7 on 91.3. And we will end today's show with a song recorded just for us at KUAF by the Time Burners. The song is called Bless Me With You. The Time Burners will be at Brick Street Brews in Rogers Saturday night, and then put April 27th, another Saturday, on your calendar. The Time Burners will be at the Fayetteville Farmers Market on that Saturday morning. You can find out much more about them, including their entire schedule, at the TimeBurners.com. Thanks so much for listening. Back tomorrow. Have a great rest of your Thursday.
As life goes by, I look in your eyes. I wonder if heaven only knew that the light of my life is an angel in disguise, and I'm here tonight holding you. I could dance with you forever in my arms. You're my every dream that came true. As we grow old together, my world is alright, and heaven has blessed me with you.
As your dark hair turns gray, I still love the way you give me that look like you do. Hand in hand, we'll dance and we'll sway, and I'm here tonight holding you.
I could dance with you forever in my arms. You're my every dream that came true. As we grow old together, my world is alright, and heaven has blessed me with you. Heaven